Hello, my name is Thompson Smiley, and this is the first of a series of programs in which I take on air the series called Smiley's Picks, which has been running for some 6 or 7 years in the Louisville Magazine. And I'm grateful to WOL and to Louisville Magazine for this cooperation, which gives me an opportunity, I think, to enthuse about Louisville's art scene and to prime you, if that's the right word, for upcoming events in the Louisville art scene. The Louisville Magazine has been good enough from time to time to allow me to write features, and in the November issue, which we're discussing in this program, I had the opportunity to put on paper some reservations and fears and worries I have, and I'd like to begin by maybe challenging you to think about an important issue. There's no doubt that the Metropolitan HD relays, which have become such a feature of Saturday afternoons, have been a stunning success. Worldwide, the number of people expected to view these is something like 2.2 million, and there's a huge number of cinemas in the United States, 1,135 last year, who every Saturday afternoon, not every Saturday afternoon, but every time there's a relay, pack these cinemas to experience something really quite extraordinary. And that is a performance of an opera live from the stage of the Metropolitan Opera to your local multiplex, in our case, either Tinseltown or Stony Brook. And this began as an experiment, I think, 4 seasons ago with a fairly modest 6 operas and maybe, I think, a couple of hundred United States cinemas across the country, and as I say, has expanded into a worldwide phenomenon with over 2 million people listening. And since opera began really as a kind of sacramental art, it was a kind of celebration of the sacred mysteries of assorted religions, I think it's not inappropriate to use almost monastic terms and talk about this worldwide congregation that gets together every Saturday afternoon to relish superbly cast productions using the latest TV technology to give you not only crystal clear sound but also miraculous visuals. I'll be talking more about that next month, because on December 11 there is the highlight for me of the entire art season, when the Met's mighty Don Carlo is broadcast complete over a five or six hour span. But the concern which I exercise in a piece called On Stage Online in the November Louisville Magazine is, do these broadcasts, which are immensely popular, very inexpensive, $22 I think is the top price, do these represent an opportunity to expand the opera audience, or do they represent a serious threat? The reason I'm concerned about that is because if you can see the world's greatest performers for $22 in comparative comfort in the cinema, why would you pay $85 or $100, or in case of the Met, maybe $250 to see the same or occasionally less experienced performers live? I mean, I would think nowadays for a couple living in New York to go to the opera and park and dine and whatnot, just talking about small change out of $1,000. So do these relays represent an opportunity or a threat, and particular to the smaller opera companies? Well, we'll be talking to David Roth shortly, not about this, but about a related issue. And he was very much of the view that where Kentucky Opera wins over the Met relays is in the complete experience. But coming to the opera house and maybe having a glass of champagne, maybe dressing up as many more young people are doing nowadays, and enjoying the evening from the cocktail through the opera to the after-show party, that complete social experience is what will win out over any digitized or artificial delivery mechanism. I'm not sure he's right, and I know other people are deeply worried. The Cleveland Opera went on record about a month ago saying that they feared that the fall in their box office, and particularly their subscription, was attributable to competition from the Met HD relays. Well, the Cleveland Opera has since filed for bankruptcy, but I really don't think that is the main reason. The main reason is that Cleveland has become something of a rust town, and that patrons are no longer willing to make the 15 or 20 minute, make that half an hour drive downtown to watch opera in a vast 19th century auditorium. The business model, as they would say in the business community, is broken. It's no longer practical to engage huge orchestras, huge choruses, and find singers with the vocal power to fill a great auditorium. If your subscription audience is both aging and declining in size. So I think Kentucky Opera has been extremely smart in foreseeing this problem and downscaling. They have moved their season out of the Whitney, and they now perform at the Brown Theatre, which in my view is Louisville's natural opera house. And the way it's been restored, beautifully painted, the pit expanded and technically upgraded, it is for me the finest opera house in the mid part of the United States. It's a much better theatre than the one in which the Opera Theatre of St. Louis plays. And for me, it's a much more welcoming space than the Chicago Lyric Opera House, which is far too vast, I think, for any sort of drama or the communication between an artist and his audience, which is the very core of what music is all about. The worry still remains, however, that when you go to the opera, and even more so when you go to the Louisville Orchestra, the audience is aging. My wife and I, both in our mid to late 60s, joke that we go to Louisville Orchestra concerts to feel young again. But the serious question is that where are the young people and where are the middle generations? The bad news is that the opera audience and every other audience in town, particularly the orchestra, is 60, 70 plus. The good news, on the other hand, is one American turns 60 every 10 seconds or so. And as Alan Cowan has pointed out, Alan is the long-term president of the Fund for the Arts. As Alan has pointed out, most of the American audience is over 60. So what's wrong with playing to the largest section of the American public? His analogy is that there comes a time in life when you tire of cheeseburgers and your tastes drift more towards sushi and filet mignon. And if that's the case, then it's possible that people mature into a love of opera, and the fact that the opera is aging is good news. When I said to Trish Pugh Jones and Brad Broker, both of whom are champions of the Louisville box office scene, that they are failing to attract the middle audience, the young married, the young middle-aged professionals, and they're playing only to the young and the old, they both responded, well, we always did. We never did have that middle audience. That people in their middle years have other concerns, putting children through school, which is a financial drain, running them to and from sports events. And as my own daughter says, if we're going to go out with the children, we're going to go to something that's affordable and family-friendly. And that, generally speaking, doesn't describe the opera or the orchestral repertory. So it's a strange conundrum. Is this the twilight of opera and live orchestral music as we know it, or is it just entering a new and different phase where they'll have to reinvent their business models in order to survive in what Rob Berman at the Louisville Orchestra calls a 1931 economy? The combination, I think, of the present economic situation, which has done terrible things to corporate donning and the like, I think is a serious concern. And the aging of the audience. But I leave it with you. Do you think the aging of the audience is either a problem or an opportunity? Maybe the focus should change from school education, which tends to be fairly ineffectual in this respect, and turn towards more adult education. That, I think, is a point to ponder, and I'll be back with you again in a few moments. Joe Makovits, for me, that's one of the most exciting sounds in the opera house, the scurrying and flurrying atop Nagasaki Hill, which heralds the opening of Madama Butterfly. And this is not your first conducting engagement with the opera by any means, but you must be excited at this upcoming production.
Absolutely. I absolutely adore this piece, and it's always great to be back here in Louisville and in my new position here as principal conductor and music director. And this piece is very special to me. I got to do it in New York and in Utah and Salt Lake City, and like you, that opening is just absolutely fantastic with the rough sound of the violins and the busy port of Nagasaki.
Yeah, Joe Makovich is one of my two guests today. Joe, as you would gather, is the new-ish music director. And my other guest is David Roth, who for 4 years now, I think, has been general director of Kentucky Opera and is doing double duty this time, stage directing the Madama Butterfly. So we have the complete creative team, if you like, here with us. David, in my extreme youth, which was also Puccini's extreme youth, it was fashionable to deride Butterfly as being manipulative and as being all pomp and no circumstance, and as being, as Benjamin Britten said, you know, he wrote loathsome music, and Shostakovich corrected him and said, yes, but he wrote great operas. do you find the music loathsome, or do you find this one of the more sentimental and beautiful pieces in the repertory?
Very much the latter. I had the pleasure of working with Colin Graham on this piece. In fact, he was one of the first stage directors that I assisted, so I really consider him my mentor. And prior to that time, I was absolutely with you in my sentiments about Butterfly. I found it maybe not loathsome, but a bit tiresome. And coming from a musical theater and theatrical background, I was quite disconnected from this interpretation of this very sad Japanese character. But it wasn't until, as I said, I worked with Colin on this production that I discovered the very heroic character of Butterfly. And in respect to her and what Puccini has created, found this beautiful woman, this fully fleshed out woman that does not make a depressed decision, but makes a very heroic decision in the end. And in that decision, Puccini has completely captured the essence of one of the great heroines in all of opera repertory.
Yes, it's a big thing with Puccini, isn't it? This little woman with the backbone of steel who comes through in the end. But I think Butterfly is really his greatest creation of that genre.
I would not at all disagree with you. Absolutely. And I think it's the culmination of his work, starting with La Boheme and searching in his composition, in his work, for authenticity and searching for theatrical authenticity, naturalism and realism, but really finding truth in the emotions, as, of course, the composers in the Verismo period were doing. He took it to another level and created great theater out of his compositions. And 8 years after La Boheme, after he did Tosca in 1900, 1904, comes Butterfly. And I would agree with you, it is the culmination of those 8 years of work and absolutely the strongest of his operas.
Oh, you think it's the strongest of them all?
I would say so. I mean, he went off in different directions, and I'm a huge fan of Turandot, don't get me wrong, his final opera, which he didn't quite complete. But there is this sense of, in Turandot, that he was experimenting and moving in a new direction and not fully fleshed out in the way that Butterfly, for me, is the complete opera. And let's also remember that he didn't quite get it right on the opening. He came back and reinvented it for Brescia, and that's principally the version that we look at now and that we find mm-hmm. so successful. But I think it absolutely deserves to be in the pinnacle, the top three operas produced around the world, because it is that good.
Yes, yes, I completely agree. And Joe, one of the surprises about the piece is that the title character, frail and fragile though she be, has to have lungs of leather and the stamina of an Olympic runner. She's on stage virtually every moment from her belated entrance through to the end of the piece. Tell me about your cast.
Oh, the cast is absolutely superb. The Chocho-san, the butterfly, is Yuna Lee. She and I did this in New York, and she has that those lungs of steel that you say. But the great thing about her is that her ability not just to soar above the orchestra when needed, but those very intimate and pianissimo moments, she secured it just so lovingly and with such care and intent.
As she would say, she's more of a lyric soprano than a dramatic soprano. And typically in big houses, you want the power of that dramatic soprano voice to sail above the orchestra. But Yuna has that power, and yet she has all that beautiful lyricism mm-hmm. to really capture the soul of this character.
Because she really does run the emotional gamut, doesn't she?
Absolutely.
From kittenish to occasionally terrifying.
Absolutely. And we've really explored that in the rehearsal hall with this production in terms of even the humorous aspects that happen in Act One. We've really looked at that so that when the patron comes to this production, they will have the entire range of emotions.
That's right. Yeah. For me, the greatest joy of going to the opera these days, and I give you full credit for this, David, the greatest joy is going to the Brown Theatre, because mine is a European background and I'm used to opera houses of 1,200 and 1,500 is considered large. So to be able to see the whites of their eyes is a is a deja vu all over again, so to speak.
Absolutely, and it really connects to some of the success that the Met has had with the opera cinema. Why has the Met that been so successful? It's because we can personally connect to those artists, and the art form now is getting back to its original form in that you have this direct emotional connection between the audience and the artist, something that we have lost in the late 20th century as opera companies moved into larger and larger houses to, I guess, earn more earned revenue to sell more tickets. But we lost a connection to the artist, and that's what we've gained, which is a huge advantage for us now in the Brown Theater, connecting our audience to that artist on stage and feeling the complete emotional arc that that artist goes through from beginning to end. And none more dramatic than what we have here with Cho-Cho-San in Butterfly.
I absolutely agree. Joe, you were talking about these pianissimo moments. I mean, these can be hopelessly lost in a larger house, can't they?
Absolutely. And you know, it's so wonderful that since we moved to the Brown that we get to investigate these parts of the palette. And our singer-actors that we have here, guest artists, absolutely fall in love with that ability and that chance to explore those softer colors. And they, too, just like the audience gets to be so close to the stage and the action and the singer-actors. Our singer-actors get to feel that energy, that visceral connection to the audience, and they love it.
And on a technical level, they get to hear themselves, don't they? The voice bounces back.
It certainly does.
Yes, I must say, I think I've never really enjoyed an opera performance at the Met. For me, it's just too vast, too big, and I never get that visceral thing where the hairs go up in the back of my neck, the way they did, for example, with Canio in that magical Pagliacci with which you opened the season. David, there are also there's no artistic decision that doesn't have business implications, and no business implications, which is why you're best off combining the two roles of general manager and artistic director. Butterfly is also one of the great popular operas of all time, isn't
Absolutely.
It?
Absolutely. Justifiably so, as we talked about earlier. It is considered worldwide one of the top three operas produced every year. It does draw audiences, and it draws just as us older fans coming to it because of our love for this piece, but it continues to draw new audiences into the art form. And we specifically programmed this opera at the end of this season so that we could launch our next season subscription, next year's campaign at the same time. A very conscious decision on our part. Ticket sales are going extremely well, and by all accounts, we should be selling out these two performances coming up on the 19th and 21st of November.
And there's nothing more gratifying than a full house. I mean, better 1,200 people in the Brown than 1,200 people in the Whitney, where it looks like a marketing disaster. But of course, there's more to Butterfly than just the title role. Give me a word or two about the tenor, and particularly Sharpless, the baritone, which I think is the second most, elevated role.
Oh, well, the tenor is we brought in Mr. Adam Deagle, who recently just did the character, the role of Fro at the Met in Das Rheingold. And he right now is the hot commodity out there. He's tall, very good looking, and has an amazing voice. We're going to be very fortunate here in Louisville to have gotten him at this point in his career. And it's really quite extraordinary. He's really competent.
Yeah, as Joe mentioned, he just did the Fro in Wagner, and he has the power and the voice to do the Wagnerian tenors, but he also has the subtlety to do all of the theatrics and beautiful music, lyrical music that Puccini or some of the Italians give him.
And I noticed that even down to the smaller parts are cast at strength. Gabriel Prisser, for example, is doing the Yamadori, which I think is one of the most wonderful cameos in opera.
And Mika Shigematsu is coming back to do Suzuki, world-renowned for her performance of Suzuki. And then we have, in the role of Sharpless, John Fanning coming back.
Good, strong casting. Strong. Well, thank you both very much indeed. And as we say in the business, break a leg with Madama Butterfly.
Thank you, Thompson.
Much.
Thank you.
hello, this is Thompson Smiley back again with what I'm going to call Final Thought. One of the great joys of doing the Louisville Magazine piece these last 7 years has been to let my hair down, if you like, in the final part of the article and rail against one or other of my bêtes noires. These have, over the years, ranged from people who cough too loud to people who cough at all, actually, through the great Louisville cliché of the standing ovation, which is awarded to anyone who has mastered a major scale on their instrument. Noisy motorbikes and, well, all sorts of things, whatever I happen to feel peeved about that particular month. I'm going to risk getting run out of town with my final thought for today, and that is the elephant in the sitting room. We talk about ourselves as a great art city, and no doubt one of Louisville's many claims to fame is the not just the variety, but also the quality of its arts. And in many ways, this is justified. There's a revitalized opera company. There's a ballet company, which has been down to hell, but which I think is on the way back. It's probably now in limbo. And, of course, Actors Theatre is deservedly a Tony Award-winning company and one of a half-dozen leading repertory companies in the United States. The Speed Museum has its admirers, and there are numerous small and interesting groups. So it is true that Louisville has an extraordinarily vibrant arts climate. We also have the highest per capita donating to the arts through that magnificent vehicle, the Louisville Fund, the Fund for the Arts, which has been directed in masterly fashion by Alan Cowan now for, I think it's 34 years. So there's much of which we can be proud. But there are also a lot of concerns. Number one is that while our civic leaders boast about the munificence of their contributions, in fact, the city, or it's now Metro Government of Louisville, is particularly stingy in its support for the arts. And every time it becomes necessary to make budget cuts, you can be pretty sure that the arts are among the first to suffer. And that, I think, is an extremely short-sighted policy. Jefferson himself said, culture was the signature at the foot of a civilization. And I think long after our businesses have been forgotten and the great corporations have gone the way of all things human, Louisville will be remembered for the quality of its arts, in the same way as Florence has forgotten its political rivalries of the Renaissance and is only remembered for the beauty of its art. Who would ever have heard of the Margraves of Brandenburg, for goodness sake, if Bach hadn't written 6 concertos for them? Everything made of born of woman withers and dies, with the possible exception of music and art and culture. And this leads me to provocatively mention an issue which nobody in Louisville is talking about at the moment, and which I might well describe as the great elephant in Louisville's drawing room. It is widely known among the arts community and among people who take an interest in these things that the life of the Louisville Orchestra, as we presently know it, is either drawing peacefully to a close or will end sometime within the next few days. Yes, it's that bad, it's that urgent, and nobody is talking about it. The reason they're not talking is because the last time the Louisville Orchestra management went into negotiations with the orchestra, there was a battle in the media with clashing editorials and rival letters to the editor, and the battle was more or less lost in public before it had been resolved in private. So I may be speaking out of turn because I know the orchestra and the management are currently in negotiations, but the fact of the matter is that the Louisville Orchestra has not really had a sustainable business model for several decades. There have been various band-aids, some of them enormous band-aids, handed to the orchestra over the years in the form of million-dollar grants, but in this 1931 economy, these are no longer forthcoming. Audiences are declining. The old milk cow, which was the pop series, has seen its audience largely evaporate, and for that reason, the orchestra is in dire financial circumstances. And you say, well, what's new about that? It's always been tottering on the verge. When I ran Kentucky Opera in 1984, we weathered a strike in the fall of that year when the orchestra players generously grandfathered the opera through the first performance, but the second one was given with piano accompaniment. So this is nothing new, but what is different is A, the economy, and B, the fact that, like Cleveland, the business model is broken, and it's clear the city has neither the will nor the ability to support 71 players. The union is always, of course, blamed in all these matters, and there's no doubt that the union's intransigence in insisting that the Orcs to be kept at a 71 level, 32 or whatever number of weeks it is guaranteed income, is going to prove financially insupportable in the coming years. The orchestra management will default on payroll very shortly, and then what happens? Does the orchestra go out of business? Does it seek Chapter 11? If it does these things, will it come back? My great anxiety is that when people say, oh yes, well all they have to do is go into Chapter 7 or Chapter 11, all contracts are null and void, and they can start all over again, perhaps with the Louisville Chamber Orchestra or some such 40-piece part-time orchestra. My fear is that if the orchestra goes away, there simply won't be the will to bring it back, and that's why I think this matter needs to be aired more clearly in the public, that the public does not deserve a sort of coup de foudre sometime in the next 10 days and discover, wake up one morning to find itself without a symphony orchestra. A number of smaller cities in Kentucky and, of course, all around the country are successfully weathering both the decline in audience size, the aging of the audience, and the economic climate. And they've done so with a totally different business model. Owensboro Symphony, which was recently written up in laudatory terms, quite rightly, by Andrew Adler in Symphony magazine, has a completely different business model. It has no players on 52-week contract or even on regular contract at all. It's a per-service orchestra, meaning that for each concert it draws upon that wonderful pool of gifted young musicians which exists around this region at Indiana University, one of the world's great conservatories of instrumental music, and where appropriate, Cincinnati College Conservatory of Music, for me, the best training school for singers in the United States, and draws upon these players and singers as needed for events, and they're paid a fee per service. That means when the orchestra season is over, the organization effectively goes into mothballs. It's a business model which has proved sustainable in Worcester. It's also a case that for the $7 million which Louisville spends in the year supporting an orchestra, there are alternatives. The Kentucky Center is bringing in the Moscow Symphony Orchestra. Danville recently brought in the Vienna Philharmonic, for goodness sake, the world's grandest and maybe greatest orchestra. So there are alternatives, but all of them are depressing and all of them need to be discussed. So when you wake up sometime in the next few days to the headlines that the Louisville Orchestra has filed for Chapter 11 or that negotiations have fallen down or any of the other ghastly scenarios which face the city, at least now I hope you'll be forewarned that these are major and complex issues. It's not stinginess on the part of the Fund for the Arts by any means. The Fund for the Arts is an extremely generous donor to the orchestra. It's just, to repeat myself, the business model of 71 players on salary for 32 weeks of the year seems to be a model which is no longer working. I'm sure this will be the subject of intense public debate, but I'd rather hope that that debate takes place before it's too late and we lose an organisation which for 75 years, yes, that's three quarters of a century, has been a bastion of Louisville's reputation as a distinguished city in the world of the arts. Well, thank you very much for listening. This is Thompson Smiley. I look forward to being back with you at regular intervals over the month to remind you of some of the upcoming events which make this such an exciting city to live and work in. Thank you.